This morning, this lesson, I've called Innocent and the Inquisition. It has a little subtitle, The Bright and the Dark. Now, you may wonder, what in the world would you call bright and what would you call dark? Think of the period that we're in church history. We're in the latter half of the Middle Ages, medieval church history. This chart had the Middle Ages beginning at 590, which is a chart that I used in college. And the reason the date 590 was selected was because that was the time of the first universal and great pope, who was Gregory the Great. So we kind of date, there's a way to date this period from there. Some people dated earlier. But as Gregory was the great pope, the first great pope, there's one pope that's considered the brightest, the high noon of the papacy. And there's a time coming where it's dark and the nadir of the papacy. This morning we're going to consider Innocent III, who was the greatest pope, in a sense. Often he's considered the greatest pope in his ecclesiastical authority, accomplishments, etc., etc., etc. So that's why I'm calling it the bright, but I'm also calling it the dark, because during the time of Innocent III, we have the rise of the Inquisition, the beginning of the office of the Inquisitor, an office that was answerable to the Pope only, not to any of the bishops, and it was an office with the purpose of ferreting out heresy in the church. So this is a bright time, this is a dark time. Innocent III, as I've said, he's the first, the greatest powerful pope. Innocent was closer to a king. He had a high view of the papacy. Hildebrand, who we'd studied a couple of weeks ago, had the same similar view. But Innocent was the one that was able to put this into real effective practice. Innocent's name was Lothario Conte. He was born in 1160 to a prominent Roman family, very wealthy, studied law in Rome, also studied in Bologna and in Paris. He was a lecturer in law at Bologna. In 1190, he was elected cardinal deacon of Rome. In my understanding, cardinal deacon would be like the head deacon of the church in Rome. It was a very exalted position, and he was a very young man. But not only was he made cardinal deacon in 1190, in 1197, at the age of 37, he was elected pope. Innocent was a short, stout man. They said he had wide, staring eyes. I'm not sure that that picture is particularly complimentary to Innocent. Frankly, I couldn't find any complimentary pictures, so I thought I would stick with this one. We're going to consider Innocent's, we won't call it life, but his work, in three areas. First, we'll consider the papacy in Italy and Europe. Innocent was the first pope to absolutely use the phrase vicar of Christ. What is a vicar? A vicar is someone, a person who stands in the place of another person. Technically, I mean a vicar is a person who stands in someone else's place. Previously, it had been said that the Pope was the vicar of the Apostle Peter. Innocent said, no. In fact, I put his quote up here, no. We are the successors of Peter, the Prince of the Apostles, but we are not his vicar, nor are we the vicar of any man or any apostle. We are the vicar of Jesus Christ himself. Bold statement. Something that the Pope has not renounced to this day. He sees himself as the vicar of Christ. He was claiming authority over all things, spiritual and political. Previously, the Holy Roman Emperor had sometimes been called the vicar of God because it was said that he was put in place by God to rule over all political and economic issues in the place of God for the good of the church. But Innocent said different. quote, "The Lord Jesus Christ has established one sovereign, the Pope, over all his as his universal vicar, whom all things in heaven, earth, and hell should obey, even as they bow down the knee to Christ." Pretty strong statement. The doctrine that allowed him to make this statement is called the doctrine of plenitude of power. Plenitude of power says that power flowed from Christ through Innocent, or the Pope, to the bishops, to the kings, and to any that would be below him. The power flowed through him. The political atmosphere at this time in Western Europe allowed Innocent to translate these lofty claims into practical realities. The Holy Roman Empire at this time extended all of the lands of Germany, some of the lands of France, down into northern Italy. And what's that? Sardinia or Corsica? That's Corsica. Sardinia is the Corsica. All right, that, so the Holy Roman Empire extended over this area. Now, Henry VI, who was on the throne from 1190 to 1197, died suddenly. And there involved a war between his successors, Otto of Brunswick and Philip of Swabia. Now, these were both German princes. They both aspired to be the emperor, but neither had enough power on his own, so there was a civil war breaking out between the two. Obviously, if there's a civil war between these two, whomever the Pope supported would get the upper hand. The Pope supported Otto. He did this for a couple of reasons. When Henry VI was the emperor, he had taken over the lands down below Rome and, in effect, had surrounded Rome. He exerted his authority to rule the whole area. Otto promised that he would, if victorious, restore what's called the Papal States, or the Patrimony of Peter. These areas, this area here surrounding Rome, is lands that Rome, the Pope, claimed that historically had been given from the donation of Constantine on to the Bishop of Rome, and this was the church's lands. Otto says, "You support me, and I will be sure that these papal lands become independent. They will be papal states, and they will be in your control." These papal states, by the way, lasted until the 19th century. Innocent backed Otto. In 1208, Philip was murdered. So in 1209, Otto was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor by Innocent. Only problem with Otto, he knew he was more powerful than the Pope, or at least he thought he was. So as soon as he became the emperor, he then reneged on his promises a little bit and began to exert his control over some of these papal lands. In fact, he was marching to Naples. Innocent didn't like this. So Innocent says, "What is the greatest power that I have? Does the Pope have armies?" Not really. He's got the Swiss Guard now. But I mean, you know, the Pope doesn't have armies. What does the Pope have? I bet you can. Excommunication. The Pope has excommunication. If you were a good Catholic, you did not want to be excommunicated. This put your soul in serious jeopardy. So, Innocent excommunicated Otto. He recognized Henry VI's young son, who was named Frederick of Sicily, as the emperor. From this time, an international conflict was brewing that Innocent was probably responsible for brewing. Otto and John of England lined up on one side. Young Frederick and Philip Augustus of France lined up on the other side. The Pope gave the throne to Frederick. He said, "It's yours." This is going to be powerful. This is going to be a problem. So you had wars between the two. Otto loses. Frederick is made the Holy Roman Emperor in 1210. This permanently weakens, the Battle of Bovines. I've got to put that up. I don't even have it. Oh, here it is in my note. 1214 at the Battle of Bovines, which was in northeastern France. Doesn't it remind you? You reckon it was a dairy area? Could have been. Anyway, the Battle of Bovines, the papal authority, the papal forces, that is, Frederick's forces and Philip Augustus's forces, won. The throne was given to Frederick. He already had the throne, but he was really now made Holy Roman Emperor. The German states and the loss of Otto, when Otto lost, the German states, in a sense, won back their power. They didn't have the emperor, but the regional monarchs and lords in Germany, which really Germany was divided into at least six provinces. These regional dukes were able to again exert more authority. This, in God's providence, is very good for the Reformation. Had Germany been totally united as a country at the time of Luther, it would have been more difficult for Lutheranism to be established and for Luther to have kept his head. We'll talk about that next fall. Anyway, it weakened the German monarch and it was good for the Reformation. Well, Innocent had now weakened the German monarch, but you see, there were still pretty powerful kings in Europe, and one of them is John. John of England, on the throne from 1199 to 1216. Innocent was determined that he would put the Archbishop of Canterbury in place. John wanted someone else. Innocent said, no, you're going to have Stephen Langton, who was a friendly person to Innocent and would do Innocent's bidding. And John said, no, this is England, and I'm going to put my man on the throne. Well, what did Innocent do to John? He didn't excommunicate him to start with. What he did, he pronounced interdict over the whole country. Interdict means literally that the clergy are forbidden to perform any religious ceremonies except funerals and baptisms if the candidate is in threat of death. Mass is suspended. Confession is suspended. Holy matrimony is suspended. They could baptize a baby and they could do a funeral, but that's it. The whole country was placed under interdict. John says, no. It's not going to make a difference. John swore that he would expel the clergy. For 4 years, John refused to back down. Innocent refused to back down. So finally, in the year 1212, Innocent excommunicated John. By excommunicating John, this removed the allegiance, the pledges of allegiance that the nobles had given to John were removed when John ceased to be, in the church's eyes, the king of England. So from,
That was plenitude.
No, the power, as Lily says, plenitude, the spigot was cut off. The power didn't go to John anymore. And the nobles said, okay, if we don't have an allegiance to John, we don't have to pay John taxes. That's a good thing. John turned around and realized that my army came from the nobles who had knights and lords pledged to them. You know, kind of like a flow chart. So when the nobles are gone, your army is gone. And John, even without modern technology of radar and other things and GPS monitors, caught wind of the fact that a force was leaving Normandy, coming across the channel, and that wasn't going to be a good thing because John didn't have anyone to meet the force with. So John says, wait a minute, wait a minute, Pope, I surrender. It only took him a year to decide to do that. And he, in surrendering, the Pope made the terms pretty severe. He says, John, for me to welcome you back into the church, you're going to have to give me a donation of all your lands. So from this point on, the lands that belonged to the monarch were given over to the Pope. So for the next 300 years, England paid all their taxes to Rome. It greatly weakened the English monarch. In the words of Dr. Nick Needham, the English monarchy, in many ways the most successful in Europe, lay prostrate in the dust at the feet of Innocent III. So, in a matter of a few years, Innocent had removed the German emperor from being the Holy Roman Emperor. He had removed the English king from the great power that he had. What's left? What country, what great power should you have left?
France.
Ah, Innocent did not leave France out. He was an equal opportunity offender, or a reducer of power, if you want to say it, from these kings. The French king was named Philip Augustus. Now, Philip Augustus came to the throne, as you see, in 1180. He was married to the 18-year-old sister of King Canute the Sixth of Denmark. Her name was Ingeborg, I-N-G-E-B-O-R-G. Well, as one, I reckon, for kings to do, he became a little bored with Ingeborg, and he had the bishops annul the marriage and put Ingeborg in a nunnery. Now, took care of Ingeborg, didn't it? He then goes out in the year 1200 and marries Agnes. Innocent says, "You shouldn't have done that." Philip says, "But I'm going to do it. I want to marry Agnes." Well, unfortunately for Philip, Agnes dies. So, what's Philip going to do? He wants to go out and marry someone else. Innocent says, No. You're going to take Ingeborg back out of the nunnery to be your wife. And what does Philip Augustus do? Takes Ingeborg back out of the nunnery, and she becomes his wife. So, in a period of, 12 years here, he has reduced the German monarch, the English monarch, and the French monarch to below him. He was a very powerful man. The three greatest powers in Europe came groveling at the feet of the Pope. I think you would say this gave the Pope, in one person's words, dizzying power. You could get drunk on your own power if you were able to do this. Well, the second area that we want to look at him is not as Pope and that, but as the internal affairs of the church. Innocent instituted a series of reforms designed for one purpose: to centralize the church government and to increase the Pope's power. He appointed men called legates. I never know how to exactly pronounce legates or legates. Legates. The legates were ambassadors appointed by the Pope to oversee church affairs. The legates were answerable only to the Pope. They didn't answer to the bishop. You see the centralization of power? The Pope has people that answer to him. You could have a powerful bishop or cardinal who was very popular, but if the legate came in the territory, he, in a sense, could tell the cardinal what to do. Innocent called a council, called the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. This council was the best attended ever in the church's history. There were 412 bishops there. There were 800 abbots or priors there. Wide-ranging moral issues were considered, and doctrinal issues were considered. Doctrinally, the doctrine of transubstantiation was formally codified as a doctrine of the church. We'll discuss this next week, because next week we're going to talk about two things: decline and doctrine. We're going to talk about the decline of the papacy and then the doctrine of the church, because we need to understand the doctrine of the church at this time to get a good setting for the Reformation that's going to come. So next week is doctrine and decline. Got my alliteration going. So we'll talk about the doctrine of transubstantiation next week. At this council, though, they also condemned heresies. The Cathars and the Waldensians were formally renounced at this council. We will speak about them in just a few minutes. Also at this council, anti-Semitism was institutionalized. Jewish people who did not embrace Christianity were forced to, one, wear distinctive clothing, two, live in a segregated area. Can we say ghetto? Can we say, and it wasn't a ghetto in the sense of the word of poverty to begin with, because the Jewish people were not poor. The Jewish people were some of your leading merchants, certainly your leading bankers, and so the ghetto was not to be thought of as a ghetto of poverty, but a segregation of where the people were placed. The Jews were expelled, or had been expelled, from England in 1209. They were expelled from France in 1306, more effectively in 1394. There was a general massacre of the Jewish people in Spain in 1391. They were formally totally expelled from Spain in 1492, and they were expelled from Portugal in 1496. So you see, from these expulsions of the Jewish people, it led to them moving to what we would call the Balkans in Eastern Europe, is an area that they were able to go, and while there were pogroms against them, they were able to live longer in the Balkans, and that's why a lot of the Jewish population after the war and whatever was concentrated in the Balkans. Why was the Jews so opposed? Dr. Needham gives a couple of reasons. One, popular stories of Jews kidnapping and murdering Christian babies was passed around. And, you know, when a story gets told and it characterizes someone that you would like to not like, it's easy for that story to be perpetrated. And this was a story that was told, and it was believed. It is as absurd to me to think of that being believed as it is to think of 27% of the African-American population in a poll in America think that AIDS was created to kill African-American people. Now, how in the world people in the 21st century take a fable like that and believe it? They did it here to a whole race of people.
They believed that the Jews had caused the plague.
Yes, they did believe.
Similar to the AIDS thing.
That's right. The next century, when the plague came, the bubonic plague that killed people at a rate that we cannot imagine. I cannot get my arms around the number of people that died. It was said that the Jews did that. Also, the plague sometimes missed the ghetto, and it might have been because the ghetto was cleaner than the rest of the town. Also, they had cats in the ghetto. Cats?
Rats.
No, they had cats in the ghetto, and so you had less rats if you had cats. And so there's several reasons that the plague sometimes would come to an area and miss the Jewish ghetto, because they were more sanitary and they had cats that got rid of the rats. Yes, Lee?
In a defense, many people are inclined to believe an assertion that the United States promulgated AIDS on black people because they did use them as test subjects.
Certainly did. The Tuskegee, absolutely. In the 1930s.
Denied.
Huh?
And denied it
for years. Years. You're absolutely right.
But they denied this too, so.
Mm-hmm. But you have intelligent, learned African-American leaders that are saying this is bunk, but they rather believe the fable because it makes them empowered and it makes them put upon, it makes them entitled, it makes them something. Anyway, it certainly made the people here turn against the Jews. Another reason they turned against the Jews was the matter of money. The church forbade usury, the lending of money for interest. The Jews were not forbidden to do this, so they gladly lent you money for interest. The Jews became the bankers. It was a practical thing. And as you hate sometimes the messenger that brings you a negative message, you hate the banker that you have to pay interest to. I collected bad debts for the bank. And, you know, when we'd go repossess a car, you know, they sure hated the one bringing the message to that person that you were coming to repossess their car, get them to pay on their note. Hey, man, I'm just bringing the message. But I could have got shot and probably came close to it. But they hated the Jews because of usury. Well, let's move to the third area of concern or examination. Oh, I put this up because in 1431, during a crusade, the people stopped in Portugal and established Portugal as a country. Forget it. The church and its adversaries and Inquisition. The rising religious dissent from 1150 onwards showed an undercurrent of social change. You had the rise of cities, people leaving the rural area, coming to the city. You had a new economic focus on capital, on money. The rich became visibly richer. The poor became visibly poorer. If you were living in a city and you had nothing to eat, you had nowhere to grow it. If you were living in the country, at least you had some opportunity to acquire food. The feudal lords were gone. Some have said that this matter of economy was one of the reasons that led to dissent in the church. I don't know. You can look for a lot of things to talk about dissent. In the history of the church, there has always been a dissenting tradition. The dissenting tradition could be called the free church tradition. There are five things that can be identified generally in a movement that is breaking from the regular official movement. One, it calls for voluntary church membership. It saw the church as believers gathered rather than a parish. In the parish concept, if you're born in a town, you're baptized, you're a member of the church. The church is made up of the wheat and the tares, and they grow up together, and the Lord will separate them at the end. But in a dissenting church or a free church, membership is voluntary. Also, the church is made up of ones experiencing the new birth. There is an experiential aspect to your Christianity. Not only do you have a voluntary church membership, you have adult baptism upon profession of faith. Mainline Christianity had been practicing infant baptism, certainly from the 3rd and 4th century on. The dissenters or the free church people saw no reason for this. They called for separation from the world. Mainline Christianity tended to be increased cultural captivity. The culture was in the church. It was together. But the dissenting church called for radical obedience, that the way you live would be totally different than the world. Absolute separation of church and state. From the 4th century on, it is believed by the free churches that mainline churches were linked directly with the state. Dissenters saw this as a perversion of God's intention for His church. Simplicity in church organization and worship. They opposed hierarchy, they opposed ornate worship, they opposed vestments. They were iconoclastic. In saying they were iconoclastic, you were saying that they were against the use of icons. Now, seeing these five general things about the free church movement, our dissenting churches, I think we can identify with many, if not all of them. How was this worked out, though, in the lives of different people in the history of the church? You can go back to the 2nd century and you can find a dissenting movement. The Montanists were a dissenting movement. The Novatians were. The Donatists in the 5th century. The Donatists who said that if you had fled persecution and then come back, you were not eligible for church membership or leadership. And so the Donatists was a dissenting movement that lasted for several centuries. Yeah, several centuries, up to about the 700s before the last Donatists were put out. Through the years, you had some people who were called the Paulicians or the Bogomils, who were saying that we're going to go to the writings of Paul for the operation of the church. In this time of the 12th and 13th century, when Innocent was, there were two groups that were in the free church or the dissenting movement. One of the, yeah, oh, Sorry, I should have looked at my notes. This is a copy of the cover of The Trail of Blood by J.M. Carroll. This was published in 1931. He wrote it before this. J.M. Carroll gives you 11 things that's the mark of the dissenting church. But the dissenting church that he finds is the Baptist church. And he conveniently tells you how the Baptist church has existed all the way from John the Baptist up to the present day. People believe this. They teach this. There is no historical fact for this, but it is a part of the landmark Baptist movement, which is a large movement. We don't know much about it, but it does exist. It was interesting, last night I went on some landmark sites just to read some things, and I found one landmark preacher up in West Virginia, and he was Big Bad John was his name, and he was, what was his initials? He had, you know, in like a What Would Jesus Do? He had initials, and he was Bad John Against the Devil, and BJ whatever. I'm telling you, people, it appeals to somebody. I had a professor in graduate school who was landmark in his leanings. He tried to keep it undercover as much as he could. He didn't last at Bob Jones a long time anyway. Okay.
Yeah. Some argue that the Reformed Baptist tradition is an illegitimate because it's outside of the true church.
Right.
Because this, that trail that goes back to John the Baptist is outside the Catholic Church.
Absolutely.
The Reformation. And,
right.
You know, they will argue that the even the 1689 confession.
Absolutely.
Now the Reformation is not legitimate.
And there are some that would argue that their heritage comes from the Anabaptists.
Correct.
Who fit in this trail of blood. And we will prove to you, we will not argue it, we will prove to you that Reformed Baptists do not come from Anabaptists next year. So you have to sign up and attend. But I will go on record as saying that Doug and I will prove to you Reformed Baptists did not come from Anabaptists. So if I'm gone, he's got to prove it. Okay, let's move. I've got 18 minutes for this. All right. The church and its adversaries and Inquisition. The first group that I'll mention are called the Cathars. They had a couple of names. They were called the Albigensians in southern France. This was a movement, as Dr. Needham says, the beliefs and practices of the Cathars were basically identical with those of the Gnostics from the early church period. What were the Gnostics? They were dualists. They said that all matter was bad. The Cathars or the Albigensians taught that the physical world of space, time, and matter had been created by Satan, who was as eternal and powerful as God. The soul, they said, was an angelic spirit kidnapped by Satan from heaven and imprisoned in an evil physical body. The ultimate sin was sexual reproduction because it increased the number of evil bodies for Satan to use as prisons for kidnapped spirits. Christ did not have a physical body. He did not really die. He did not experience a bodily resurrection. Salvation did not come through the cross, but through the spiritual enlightenment, accepting and following the Cathar teachings. Cathars rejected water baptism and Holy Communion. The whole doctrine of the Gnostics and the Cathars was reintroduced to us and brought into discussion with the Da Vinci Code and the Gospel of Judas and Bart Ehrman 2 years ago. I don't have any time to talk any more about this. The Cathars or the Albigensians were found to be two groups, the pure ones, and the other groups are called the believers. It was very interesting that they became popular amongst the noblemen. There was 500,000 followers of this by the year 1200. But you see, if you were a follower of this, you didn't have to pay taxes to the Pope. So I don't know if these noblemen were really true believers or if they were looking for the way to get out of taxes. We'll leave that. What, brother?
Tax exempters.
Yeah, they were tax exempters. Anyway, the Albigensian Crusade is something that began around 1209 to 1229. This is a bad picture of Albigensians being murdered. It was a brutal, brutal time. Now, I'm not going to discuss them anymore because I want to move to a dissenting group that we can identify with a little more. Yes, Miss Peggy. I know Miss Peggy thinks the Cathars are better than I think they are.
I do. Well, okay. I think
that
along.
No. Okay.
The Pope's man who annihilated the Cathars, and he really did just obliterate them.
He did.
A man named Simon de Montfort.
Mm-hmm.
And when I lived in England, Simon de Montfort was considered the father of the British Parliament, the place where the Reformed
conference, the Banner of Truth conference in Leicester is in Simon de Montfort Hall, and it was just amazing to me to think that this man was such a brutal, bloody killer, and here he is just revered all over the place in Britain, but the guy in Britain was his son, and he was a different piece of cloth altogether. So the one in Britain is considered the father of the modern parliamentary system altogether, but he was the son of the guy who was the brutal murderer of all the Cathars.
Well, the brutal murderer had to be an inquisitor.
Yeah, I guess he was.
Oh, he had to be.
He was appointed by the Pope to do it.
That's what I mean. The Pope appointed inquisitors who were given total authority. And I know we won't get to it, so I'll just go ahead and talk about the Inquisition, the actual office of Inquisition right now, because what happens is they're answerable to the Pope. And as they went into a town, there was virtually no way that you could escape if they, in these words, once an Inquisition had once the Inquisition had accused a person of heresy, it was almost impossible for that person to prove his innocence. Now, you could admit your guilt, and then you'd be given penance to do. The penance would be to pay something if you were wealthy, to make a pilgrimage, to do something like that. But if you tried to hold for your innocence, you just about could not do it. And the Inquisition was a terrible, terrible time. The Inquisition, in my notes I have, was a separate organization within the Catholic Church, free from episcopal control and subject only to the Pope, dedicated exclusively to uncovering and punishing heretics in Catholic Europe. The two movements that worked with the Inquisition were the Dominicans and the Franciscans, men that we could admire for some other things that they've done, but they provided the friars to become the inquisitors. Well, who is the second group that I'm going to talk about as a dissenting movement at this time? And this is a group called the Waldensians. The Waldensians, and something I put here in my note to remember, history is usually written by the victorious and powerful. So what you read in history is what they want you to read about something. And so you can read some stuff about the Waldensians that's, I think, total fabrication, and it's very hard to get to the truth. I think what I'm going to teach here for the next 12 minutes is supportable about the Waldensians. Waldo Leon of Valdez of Leon, we're not sure when he was born. He died around 1217. He was the son of a high social class. He was a wealthy merchant. He was well integrated into the political community of Lyon, France. He was a man of influence, a man of the establishment. Around the years of 1173 to 1176, we're going to call him Waldo. Waldo made some decisions that radically changed his life. First, he commissioned the translation of several books of the Bible into the local dialect, which was French provincial, Provençal, P-R-O-V-E-C-A-L, how do you say it? Provençal. The French language was not established yet as a language for the whole nation, but this was the French that was spoken in that area. It's interesting, this decision did not meet opposition. He even went to Rome, it is said, and presented the translation of these books of the Bible to the Pope. The Pope thought it was okay. Gave his blessing, no problem. But then Waldo abandoned his business and distributed his goods to the poor. This was a drastic move. Now, it wasn't drastic in the sense that other people had not done this, because vows of poverty were taken by people all the time when they entered into the monastery. So that wasn't. But this was drastic for him to do this. There is a story that he may have heard the song of a minstrel talking about a persecuted people, and that led him to this decision. I don't know. But one thing it led him to the decision was his literal interpretation of the words of our Savior to the rich young ruler in Mark 10:22. If you wish to be perfect, sell what you have and follow me. Waldo accepted this as a direct, unfettered command, and he did. He sold his possessions. he began to share a gospel message. But you see, he didn't enter a religious life like others who had vowed poverty. He remained free, but he began to speak. The Pope sent a representative to question him because some of his friends were joining him. Waldo says, supposedly, "We have decided to live by the words of the gospel, essentially that of the Sermon on the Mount, and the commandments, that is, to live in poverty without concern for tomorrow. But we hold that all those who continue to live their lives in the world doing good will be saved." He didn't say that salvation only was with the ones who were doing what I'm doing. But this is what we're going to do. And you know, if it ended at this, the printing of a few books, the giving away of your goods, doing good deeds, this probably would have been okay. But there was a third element to Waldo's personages. He determined to preach the gospel in public. This was a very significant decision. He took passages from the church fathers. He translated St. Augustine and Ambrose and Jerome. He used these. He went out. He spoke. His followers spoke. This wasn't good. The Bishop of Lyon kicked him out of town. Waldo's answer to him was, "It is better to obey God than man." Does anyone recognize where that quote came from? "It is better to obey God than man"? Acts. Who said it, Michael?
Peter did.
Mm-hmm.
Peter and the Apostles.
Peter and the Apostles. From this time on, in history, we look back and oftentimes you hear Waldo called Peter Waldo. Never in the documents was he called Peter Waldo. But Peter was ascribed to his name because, as the Apostle Peter answered, "It is better to obey God than man," Waldo answered that. So some people call him Peter Waldo. Well, what about the Waldensians? This is the area of Europe stretching from, this is Lyon. This is the area that the Waldensians lived in. Lyon, Milan being the most prominent towns. From the earliest days, the movement's members were called the poor. One of their Latin, what would you call it, ways to describe themselves? Lux lucet in tenebris, light shining in darkness. You find this on an inscription, on a medallion that has these words on it. For more than three centuries would pass before the Waldensians would build their own church buildings. They lived as Roman Catholics, but they lived as a poor, scattered community, but they were close-knit to one another. They held to the scriptures, they held to the life of poverty, in conformity to the example of the apostles, and they also held to the practice of preaching. Some have said, why did the Waldensians even exist? You can give several answers. Possibly the strength of their convictions, or the strength of the conviction of a single believer. This is probably inadequate because, you see, there were other believers that never formed into a group or never left. Some have said that there were reasons of social and economic nature that pressed them to this. But I would say, and an author that I read gave this, he said, "The movement of the poor was able to survive the Middle Ages because it never closed itself with a sectarian spirit. That is, it did not see itself as an exclusive group spiritually superior to other Christians. Rather, it knew how to continuously renew itself spiritually and theologically." They lived in this Piedmont area of northern Italy, and they maintained their existence, never saying that the Roman church was totally wrong. They never said that they were the only church. So you see, they differed from the dissenting movement a little bit in this way. There's three things that signify them. They believed that they had the right to hear the word of God. They believed that they had the obligation to live in voluntary poverty. And they not only the obligation, the right to live in voluntary poverty, but the obligation to preach the gospel, to share the message. This preaching in public is the thing that got them into most trouble. Waldo, we said, was expelled from Lyon. It's interesting that the Waldensians never called themselves brothers or disciples. They used business language. They called themselves co-members of a society. They did not want to be thought of as a new church. They wanted to be thought of as a group of laypersons who were collaborating for a precise goal, and this goal, the preaching of the gospel. This dedication to preaching provoked a strong reaction from the church. Boy, did it ever. And it led to a search for the poor of Lyon and to their excommunication as heretics. Well, the authority that they operated under, they believed that they were called to proclaim Christ. They believed that the authority to preach did not come from the Pope, but it came from the apostles. And if you followed the example of the apostles, you had the right to preach. They believed that women had the right to preach. They were against the state and the church being together. One method of their spreading of their gospel was by the use of men called barbas, or uncles. This word literally means uncle. These men would be trained by spending an extended time with older barbas, and they would be taught the word. Then they would be sent out two by two. They always went two by two. And they went out as merchants. They didn't go out as preachers, because, you see, they had to go out undercover. So they went out, and they would go to a town, and I can imagine peddling. I've done some of it myself. And they opened their cart, and, you know, they said, I've got this bright little trinket here, and they sold that, and I've got this thread. And they would talk about, though, that they had something of great value. They had something that could be considered the pearl of great price. And if people would pick up on it, then they would bring out the Bible. And they would share with them the gospel. But they would only stay in a town 2 or 3 days. They would leave under cloak of darkness after they had shared the pearl of great price. This is a way that they shared the gospel. Some have said that the Waldensians, since they were not well organized, they didn't have seminaries, they must have been uneducated. But it has been found in the writings of these barbers, they had a small pocket-sized volumes containing sermons, tracts, poems, and grammar lessons. They showed us, as it said, the vast cultural world of the Waldensians. Many of these small things are theological works coming from Hussite sources, which were not only translated but adapted and elaborated. These accomplishments, in the words of one of their historians, requires sensibility and competence beyond that of the simple and uneducated. Waldensian theology may have been a little bit too aligned with Rome. It may not have understood justification by faith alone. They certainly believed in sola scriptura. They certainly believed in the authority of the Word of God above anything else. As Reformation thought began to come out, I mentioned Huss, the preaching of John Huss, the Bohemian pastor of Bethlehem Chapel in Prague, who was burned at the stake in 1415. His followers, the writings of Huss, the barbas accepted these. They became to have a fuller understanding of the gospel because of this. Finally, as the Reformation began to spread, in around 1526, the barbers met, about 100 and some of them met, and began to consider the teachings of Luther. And then they were on their way to a synod in the town of Chanfouron. I'm not sure where that is, but that's the name of it there. And in 1532, there was over 176 of the barbers, and they had met William Farrell. We all remember Farrell as being the French-speaking preacher in Geneva and the area of Geneva who was instrumental in getting Calvin to Geneva. Farrell had met these and had instructed them. They accepted the Reformed teaching. They accepted the message of the Reformation. You couldn't say that from 1532 the Waldensians were brought into the Reformation church, because there wasn't a Reformation church in 1532, but there was a Reformation movement, and the Waldensians became part of the Reformation movement. Some have said, were the Waldensians Protestants before Protestants existed? I wouldn't say that, but in fact, I don't think you can prove that. You can make an argument for it, but they certainly were a discernible group of people who operated underground, They faced much persecution, and they would face persecution after this. And when presented with a fuller view of truth, they accepted it. To me, that's significant, that when a movement that may have some deficiencies in its doctrine is presented clearer truth, and they embrace the clearer truth, that tells me that there was life there to begin with, because darkness doesn't embrace truth. The Waldensians embraced truth, and they continued to exist. The Waldensians were persecuted in 1560. The Duke of Savoy came into the Piedmont area and just wiped them almost out. Oliver Cromwell, Lord Protector, had written down there, said, you know, he admired these people. In fact, it is said that in the late 1550s, they painted the inside of some of the church buildings in England. They would have a red wall, and that would remind them of the persecution that was going on in the Alps area of their brethren at this time. John Milton wrote a poem for the Waldensians that I copied, and I put it in nice meter and separated it, and I forgot to put it on here, so I won't give you Milton's poem as we're out of time. But the Waldensians went to different areas. They went to Ecuador and to Argentina in the 19th century, and in 1893, a group of 20 Waldensians went to Burke County, North Carolina, and they founded the town of Valdez, and I've passed Valdez 100 times. They brought with them their Waldensian pastor from Europe to pastor the church there. They have an outdoor drama that gives you the tale of the Waldensians. They worked in textiles, they worked in furniture, and they worked in bakeries. Does anyone know about the Waldensian bakery? It was a bakery that employed over 600 people, and they made sunbeam bread. Now, I worked for Holtzman Bakery, Jones Brothers, in Winston-Salem and Bible College. Holtzman was not batter-whipped air bread like Sunbeam. We had real bread, had a little more substance to it, because I never liked Sunbeam, but because our bread was tougher. But anyway, the Waldensian, I knew the Waldensian bakery before I ever knew that Waldensians were a sect of people. Are they a gospel-believing people today? They are a Protestant people in Italy, and I really don't know anything about the Waldensians. Most of the Waldensians, when they came to the United States, and they came as early as 1656, they aligned themselves either with the Dutch Church or later the Presbyterian Church. You can go, they say, to Staten Island and see a plaque for the Waldensians that came there as early as that time. Well, next week, Doctrine in Decline. Thank you so much.